Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my honor to be in dialogue with Katerina Chapkova and Eliana Adler. Katerina is a senior researcher at the Institute of Contemporary History in Prague. She also teaches at Charles University and NYU, New York University in Prague. Eliana Adler is an associate professor in the Department of History and the Program in Jewish Studies at Pennsylvania State University. They are the editors of the newly published volume, Jewish and Romani Families in the Holocaust and Its Aftermath, published by Rutgers University Press 2021. Thank you for your time today. It is my absolute honor to be in dialogue with you, and I feel sincerely blessed.
Thank you so much for your invitation.
To begin, can you tell us about yourselves? Where did you grow up? What formative events in your lives catalyzed the scholars you would become as adults?
So I grew up in Northern California. My family moved there because my father, who was a history professor, got a job there. So I was surrounded to some degree by history, and it's always been an interest of mine. But I think having a family member in the field made it seem possible, even that it was something that one could legitimately do. And I study East European Jewish history, and that comes from a number of different reasons. But I would say I became aware when I was in college of just the sort of sense of a missing connection, that is, because of the Holocaust, a break between American Jews and their past, and a lot of holes to be filled in to understand what life was like and where people came from. And that seemed like an interesting and important direction for me.
Thank you for sharing that. Katerina, can I ask you?
So I was born in Prague in the early 1970s, which means that I spent my childhood and majority of my teenage in communist Czechoslovakia, and that definitely had an impact on my whole life. My father was a Protestant pastor or minister, and my mother was a psychologist for children, and they were both anti-communist. So I, from the very early years of my life, there are four children of us. So we grew up in the knowledge that we are under dictatorship, and that we are persecuted as Christians, and also that we have to live in lies. That was really a very important experience that I am, to some extent, actually happy to have, because I experienced also the end of the of communism. That I experienced this living in lies, living in propaganda. At school especially, we were taught lies about not only present times, like that the Communist Party is the best, but also about past. For example, about 1968, we were taught that that was the year when the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact saved us from the capitalists, and it was great that at home I could discuss that with my parents, who explained to me that 1968 was the best year of their lives because of Prague Spring, and that they experienced democracy, limited one, but still freedom of speech. So I think this was also an experience which brought me to history to understand the different interpretations and to go into the sources.
Thank you for sharing that. What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
Well, in terms of our book, I would say there's really two main ideas that make it new that we hope that people, readers, listeners will get out of it. And I'm sure we'll talk more about both of them. The first one is, of course, just the family lens, sort of the idea that thinking about the past using the perspective of family has something to offer that we gain from it. And the second one is putting into conversation Jewish and Romani experiences of the Holocaust in Europe, again, that we learn more, or we have the potential to, when we do that. And this is, both of these, I think, are relevant to our scholarship and very much also to our teaching.
What inspired you to prepare this book? What message do you hope to convey to readers?
So for the book, there was a conference that Eliana and I organized in May 2017, I think. It was the conference had a similar title. It was called The Holocaust and Its Aftermath from the Family Perspective. And in the call for papers, we emphasized that we encourage scholars to focus not only on Jewish history, but also on Romani cases. What followed was quite a surprise for us, because there was an enormous interest. We were really shocked by the number of applications, which obviously show that the topic has a potential and it starts a fruitful discussion. And we were also amazed by the creativity, or the ways how scholars approach this topic from very different and sometimes really very innovative point of views. And so it was extremely hard to choose only a few of the applications for the conference, which lasted only 2 days. And then out of these contributions, we have chosen some of the scholars we asked to write a study for the book, because after the conference, we were quite sure that this should not be end of our discussion, but that we think our results should be published. So this was also how the team was established. It was an open call for papers. And what was very important for us and was also that not only that there were few, but still some abstracts related to Romani history, but also that there was a number of excellent applications from scholars from Central and Eastern Europe who use the local archives. They have material which nobody has discussed before or has read before. And I think that makes also our volume quite unique.
Can you summarize your book for us? What are the most important ideas in your book?
The book begins with an introduction, which really lays out what we hope to gain from the family perspective and suggests some methodological approaches and where we've seen elsewhere. We've read, you know, other works that use these kind of methods and ask these kinds of questions. And then the rest of the book is case studies. So, and it's quite a diverse group in terms of geography, methods, disciplines, languages used. The papers are quite distinct, and they come from all over Europe, and they used real diversity of sources. but they all put questions about the family at the center, and thus they are in dialogue with one another, even though they are very different in many ways.
How did the two of you meet? Can you tell the story?
We actually met at a conference. We just happened to both be in the same panel, and we walked out of it somewhat frustrated and got to talking, and on the spot, pretty much, without knowing each other, without having read each other's work, without having any kind of recommendations or sense of one another, except for just that initial interaction, we basically made a decision that, first of all, that this a family perspective was lacking, and that the papers that we had just heard would have benefited. But secondly, we made a decision that we were actually going to make a conference about it. And after that first meeting, we went our separate ways, but continued to keep in touch and managed to raise some money and make some plans. And it happened that we were both going to be in Central Europe in, you know, the following year, and the conference and then the volume came out of that serendipity.
Why did you choose to focus on family? How does a perspective that emphasizes family differ from a perspective that focuses on gender as an analytical lens? Can you elaborate on this?
First of all, I would say that the perspective emphasizing family comes out of gender studies, that it becomes possible to think in these ways and to have the tools to study the family because of how much we've all learned in recent decades from the introduction of gender studies to so many academic fields. So I see them very much as complementary. I think there have been some people who were concerned that in some ways family studies was trying to compete with gender or supplant it in some way, and that is not at all the case. It's all about, you know, we need all the tools we can to understand the past. And if we have these collaborative, multi-directional, multidisciplinary methods, we all benefit and learn more. I would say that one of the things that I've learned from applying this family perspective is that individuals who are alone and who talk about themselves in their testimonies and write about themselves in their memoirs, or who in the documents appear to be alone, in certain ways are, genuinely are alone, but often also have networks, families that are part of their experience before the war, during the war, and after the war, and that recognizing those ties helps to understand parts of their experience, decisions that they made, and how the war affected them and the genocide affected them in some really profound ways.
Thank you for sharing that. How do you define family in this project? What does the term family include and exclude?
I think from the beginning, when we discussed, Eliana and I, this concept of the conference and later of the book, it was obvious to us that this concept could be also criticized because people, especially based on their experience of how family is discussed in political debates, family is sometimes seen as a conservative concept of heterosexual couple with children, and that we might have this concept in mind, but this is not true at all. We try to explain that in the introduction, that our concept of family is as open as possible, meaning that we are very flexible in accepting any relations, like a partner's relation or relation to, with children. And not only this, as our book shows, we also are open to concepts that is developed, especially in the chapter of Natalia Alexion, about surrogate families, about people who were in her chapter. It's about people who were for quite some time together in hiding and therefore developed a relationship very close to one where you have somebody as a relative. And so we are very flexible in this and open. And I think it is a pity that sometimes the family, and the term family is understood in a very narrow definition, because I think it's a word we are all using, and we should not change the word, but rather expand the definition of it. The other thing I would like to mention is that we also do not glorify family. I think there are, of course, many cases were, and countless cases of sacrifice for family members, for a partner in the Jewish or Romani context. But at the same time, we also do not hide the negative sides, and that family can be also a burden for an individual. And this is discussed especially in the very unique study we have in the book written by Michal Unger from Israel about divorces in ghettos in Łódź and in Warsaw, where she analyzes cases where some people, because of this drastic living conditions and were it's about survival. Some of them rather decide to be egoistic and actually can even use the portions of food from the family members. So this is, and there are other examples of this relations with somebody in the family. Another chapter in our book deals also with this negative side of having family networks. It's the study of Joachim Schlör, who discusses family in Germany, where the daughter decides, because of the conflict with the family, to go to exile in Great Britain, and she's seen by the family as a traitor, and the whole trip of hers is seen as betrayal. But when the war starts, it's exactly this one member of the family who is a hope for the whole for all those relatives, and even if she also has such a negative experience with the family from the pre-war, she decides, of course, to do her best to help them out.
Thank you. In what ways did family considerations influence the decisions that Romani and Jewish survivors and victims made during the Holocaust?
I think there are so many ways that family influenced decisions throughout, and as well as before and after. I can give an example from my own work, and this relates to we discuss it in the introduction. It also relates to some of the papers, but decisions about flight. Often, the decisions Well, first of all, it's hard to understand the choices people had just with the heaviness of our back shadowing. It's so hard to understand what they knew and didn't know, what the conditions under which they were facing their questions. But even if we can wrap our minds around that, sometimes it is very hard to understand the choices that people made, that they don't make sense according to our terms, if we think of individuals sometimes as individuals. But when we place them within a family, we can at times understand their decisions differently. And here again, I don't want to glorify or justify, but just provide, I think, important context in some cases. So for example, with many young Polish Jewish men who fled in 1939 with the dual invasions, who fled eastward into Soviet territory. In some cases, they did so just to save themselves and to get away. But in many cases, they did so as part of decisions with their nuclear family, with their extended family, debates over who would be targeted and how they would be targeted and what was the best chance for the whole family, or at least some parts of it, to survive, to get through this. And so sending young men, sending all young people across the border into Soviet territory was sometimes a family strategy, which at times meant just go and be safe, or at times it meant go and find out what the conditions are and decide if we should all join you or if you should come back. And sometimes those later steps weren't possible. But we can see how when we pay attention to these questions and ask them and bring them to the sources, we can see how much import family had in people's lives and decisions.
To what degree was the family a specific target of German wartime policies?
To me, this is one of the examples of, and I know this is, Genocide Studies Forum, the ways in which the study of the Holocaust and of genocide studies can really inform one another. The German policies before the war and during the war very much targeted families. And again, if we bring that perspective, sometimes it changes how we view, that is, taking men away for labor or early killings or incarcerations. Sure, that did have the effect of taking away the defenses of the people, making them less able to take care of themselves, physically speaking, that is, taking away young men who could have possibly provided some physical protection. But it also very much attacked the family as an institution, attacked the bonds of the family and the ways in which emotionally families function and support one another. And we can see that in some of the Nazi laws and policies already in the very early 30s, the ways in which the family was gradually, of these people deemed to be enemies of the state, their families were pulled apart, were weakened, were humiliated, the bonds destroyed as a way of weakening their entire communities, societies, and ability to survive what would come later.
The fact that you included Roma and Romani perspectives and history in your book makes it a real gem. Why did you decide to focus on Roma and Romani here?
I think it has to do with the concept of family. So if we think about communities that were targeted as a whole, as really from the babies to the elderly people, this was the case of the Jewish community and the different communities of Roma and Sinti. So this is why we thought they definitely have to be included. And I think, in a sense, yes, our book is one of the first that makes this yeah, that combines research on Roma and on Jews. But in the future, I very much hope that this will be actually this will become a standard, because I think it's really obvious that if we focus on racial victims of Nazism, it's Romani and Jewish people, and it and as I hope our book also shows, it's so enriching for both scholars on Jewish Jewish history and scholars on Romani history to be in dialogue together, and so this is so why I hope this is only a start.
What were the differences and similarities between the genocide perpetrated against the Roma and the genocide perpetrated against the Jews?
So as for the similarities, it's actually, I have said that already. It's really this racist attack on a community where the whole communities should disappear. So this is similar, and this is also why we understand the term Holocaust to include definitely Jews as well as Roma. There are also differences because each genocide, any genocide, is unique. So also the genocide of Roma is unique, and as well as genocide of Jews. What we have found in our book as the major difference was that, in contrast to the Jewish communities, Romani communities did not have their own organizations, or organizations that would include most of Roma and Sinti in a territory or even a state. Or there was also no international Romani organization, which is quite a difference, because as we know, Nazis have misused the fact that there are Jewish religious communities, and they those communities were forced to take part in the organization of the genocide, which had both like positive and negative sides. Yeah. It was horrible that it was some of the Jewish leaders that who had to put together, for example, lists of those who will be deported from a ghetto to extermination camp. But at the same time, it was also positive in a sense that, for example, in the Jewish ghettos, there was a Jewish leadership which tried with different strategies, tried to improve the living conditions in the ghetto as much as possible. So, for example, in Theresienstadt, the ghetto in Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, especially children were protected. They got better food and were accommodated separately, and also the sanitary and hygienic situation in the ghetto was regulated in such a way by the Jewish administration that it's remarkable how little diseases spread there, even though it was so overcrowded. And that's in great contrast to, for example, the camps for Roma and Sinti. There were two such camps in Protectorate Bohemia, Moravia, and Leti in Hodonin, that were led by Czech gendarmes, And there were horrible living conditions. It's known that the Czech gendarmes even stole some of the food of the Roma and Sinti. And diseases spread quickly. And of course, the first victims were the children. So this is really a big difference. In our book, we have three parts. The first is about family during the genocide. The last one is about family in the aftermath, in the post-war years. And in the middle, we have a part about the institutions. It's called Interventions of Institutions. And this is the only part in the book where we have no chapter about Roma, because we could not use this focus. I don't know whether there is time for another difference, but I, from my later research, from my recent research, I would actually now emphasize another difference. Between the genocide of Jews and Roma, and that's which I find more crucial, and that's that on one hand both communities suffered as victims of racial discrimination in the Roma and Sinti, mostly because of the different color of skin. Jews were murdered as Jews. In context of Roma and Sinti, they were not murdered as Roma and Sinti, but they have another additional burden to live with, and that's that they were murdered as allegedly asocials, or so it was. There was a word, work shy. So it's this another burden that not only that they were exterminated, nearly exterminated as racist victims, but on top of it, they were humiliated by this terminology, which had a huge impact on the post-war and on the way how, yeah, the Holocaust of Roma is still struggling to be recognized, and also when some of the victims try to get some recognition, or they often met with a refusal, because with the argument that you were in the camp as a criminal, which is awful, and I think. We should recognize this like double suffering in order to fully acknowledge the experience of Roma and Sinti.
What sources were used in the articles presented in this book?
The authors of the articles used a wide array of sources. I would say one potential commonality is that in many cases, the sorts of questions that they were asking required reading against the grain to some degree. And that's particularly the case for the institutional archival sorts of documents. So Robin Judd, for example, used Allied documents to look at marriages between Allied service members and Jews in particular, and survivors, Jewish survivors, and the ways in which the sort of institutional and military understandings of family and of marriage affected people's ability to make their own choices. So those documents, she's looking at them, I would say, in a new way there. And that was the case in some of the other articles as well. Laura Hobson Foer used institutional Jewish and also non-Jewish aid, philanthropic organizations, and the ways in which after the war, also their understandings of family had profound, surprising, sometimes detrimental effects on siblings and the ways in which the institutions deciding what was the right place for them, what was the right family for them to be in, sometimes separated, tore apart what it was that they had left, whatever family was remaining. On the other hand, Vola Bartosz didn't have to read documents in different ways because she conducted her own ethnographic interviews with Romani families in the Belarusia and Lithuania, a population that hasn't, like many, gotten a lot of attention, and there hasn't been a lot of interviews with looking at how different types of family, sedentary, migratory, those who were in between those categories were treated, how they understood themselves, how they were understood by the Germans who came in. So a lot of different types of sources, traditional, less traditional, personal ads being a surprising one, that Sarah Wobik-Segev read personal ads to look at how people described themselves and what they were looking for in potential partners, and the ways in which, the unexpected ways in which sometimes even Nazi racial terminology ends up in Jewish personal ads as they categorize themselves and try and understand themselves in the wake of the war and the ways in which they had been understood.
What can scholars of other genocides and students of other mass killings learn from this volume? How can specialists in other atrocity situations learn from your book's insights?
So something that I have learned from genocide studies is the ways in which genocides unfold in stages. And when we look, it's, to my knowledge, there is no situation in which overnight the extremity, the mass killing that we associate with genocides comes in. It's always a process over time. And as we look at a variety of different genocides and come to understand those stages and where they are similar and where they are different, bringing the family in is one way to get at those questions and potentially to begin to understand how perpetrators of genocide function, where their attacks come from, who they're aimed at, so that we can recognize, ideally, some of those tactics before they reach their most extreme stage. And we see that in some of these articles, both from the outside, that is, the ways in which decisions made by outside entities affected families, but also very much from the inside, of how victim populations make decisions and try to survive when not only their lives, but their societies and their families are very much under attack.
What are the similarities and differences between Nazi anti-Gypsyism and contemporary anti-Gypsyism?
Definitely is a huge difference. Because as we discussed already, under Nazism, the aim of Nazi regime was to kill all Roma and Sinti. And even though there is a very profound anti-Romani, anti-Sinti racism, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, where South Europe, Southern Europe, where most of the Romani communities live in Europe, we should recognize that there is this huge difference. At the same time, it's really disturbing that that this community, these diverse communities, face discrimination until today on a daily basis. And it's a structural racism, meaning that not only are there, unfortunately, in most of these countries, neo-Nazis in parliament who deny, for example, the existence of the genocide of Roma, but on top of it, it's really structural, meaning that members of those communities have limited access to education, to they have problems to find a place to live because of the prejudices of the neighbors, and so this is also why part of those communities are still living in poverty. So this is definitely very disturbing, and I'm glad that there is now a growing number of Romani scholars, because I think as in the Jewish context, it's very important that the history is also studied by members of those communities. It's not should be done dominantly by somebody else. So this is important. At the same time, you probably could see that in my answer used the term anti-Gypsyism, and that is for purpose, because the more I am involved in research of Romani history, the more I am concerned with language. And as I've mentioned about the difference between Jewish and Romani genocide experience, I think it is quite hard now for me to accept speaking or writing about Roman Sinti, where we would speak about them about gypsies or in the Central European context as Cigoyner or Cikan in Czech. It is actually my hope that in the future we will deal with those terms as with the N-words in context of Afro-Americans. We are not that far, unfortunately, but I hope we will become more sensitive. And in a sense, I am now... It's really interesting how this has also impact on my language use for the Jewish history, that the more I think about it, the more I have problem with the word anti-Semitism. It's in a sense that it is a concept, it is an artificial nonsense concept developed in the 19th century in Germany. And so even by using this word, we somehow bring those ideologies back into our discussions. I think it's more proper to use terms like anti-Jewish violence, anti-Jewish prejudices. So it's interesting how this my involvement in the Romani studies somehow has an impact on my speaking about Jewish history as well.
Many of the articles in this volume span various periods of World War II and various periods of the post-war era. Can you discuss the role of family considerations in different post-war trajectories and in determining post-war trajectories?
So this was very important for us, and Eliana, please add to it if I do not explain it properly or extensively enough. It was from the beginning, as you could see, it was already in the title of our conference. It was, I think we could add that as probably the third thesis of our book, meaning that the suffering hardly ever ended with the end of the war. And if we focus on a genocide experience from the family perspective, this is totally obvious that the war was only the beginning of the, in many times, very painful search for the relatives. And searching where to start new life, with whom, where, because in many cases their property was already taken or destroyed, and because one often did not want to live on the in the space where you had these memories of large families before the war. So there is a huge migration of Jews as well as of Roma. Even though in the case of Roma, this migration is mostly within the territory of one state or within Europe. So this is one point why we thought there's no way we can stop with the end of the war. And also, we think that especially through the lens of a family, we see that that the trauma is staying with the family. I must admit that this is again the chapter of Joachim Schler, that it was very clear to me, thanks to his study, that, for example, also those. We could say success stories of families where all of the members survived in this case, because they could use this contact to the daughter in Great Britain. But this huge suffering and feelings of being guilty that they did not probably, or whether they could do more for the other members of the families, and the feeling guilty to survive. Yeah, so. So those are very powerful stories, which enable us to understand more the post-traumatic situation of families.
If I could just add, I think sure. What you said, Katka, about this being sort of one of the other major findings of the volume is very important, really. And in addition to what you said, I would just add that there's a way in which, because the Holocaust is so big, so heavy, so dramatic, that it's often pictured as a rupture, as whatever came before is lost, whatever came afterward is new, blank slate. But when you bring in the family perspective, there's this really compelling through line. And once you start seeing it, you can't unsee it anymore. That after, you know, after being involved in this project, when I read memoirs on and I'm looking for something else, it's so obvious to me now the ways in which family before, during, and after remains a central concern for so many people. And the Holocaust, of course, it changes their lives in major ways, but it doesn't necessarily change that aspect and that focus.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you kindly tell us on where your attention has gone since completing this project? What are you working on next? As your current project, what are you both working on now?
So, I'm now actually working on two projects. One is very much in connection, or it's very close to our book. I have a project where I could put together a team of scholars, and we are writing a history of genocide, of entangled genocide experience of Jews and Roma in Central Europe. The idea of the book is that we compare the situation of Jews and Roma in the protectorate Bohemia and Moravia, in the Slovak state, and in Hungary. And the preliminary thesis is that the policy towards Jews and Roma, the communities and Jews and Roma differed that much. The communities differed in demographic way, in social way, that in a sense, you may say that it was more crucial for a person where he or she was during the war than whether she or he was Roma or Jews or a Jew. So that's the preliminary thesis, and we hope to finish that book soon. So it should be submitted at the end of this year. So that's one project. The other one is a different one, again with two other. The first one is with many co-authors, but this one with two co-authors, Chad Bryant and Diana Dumitru, and we are writing a book about Slansky trial, which was the major communist trial with group of communists in leading positions in Czechoslovakia, who were most of whom were Jews, and so it was one of the major anti-Jewish political trial in communist Europe in the 50s.
I'm currently working on a project about memory and commemoration and grassroots efforts by Jews to think through and respond to what happened to them and to their losses through memorial books, through, they're called in Yiddish Yitzkerbücher, these volumes that are put together by transnational groups of survivors and refugees from the same hometowns, and focusing chiefly on those towns in pre-war Poland. But thinking about the genre more broadly, also what it comes from, where they got the idea, how they created these volumes, why it was meaningful to them, and the ways in which they developed.
Thank you. I'm extremely grateful for your time, your erudition, and your eloquence in our dialogue today. I can hardly thank you enough, both for the time we've shared together and for this remarkable, important, and precious volume.
Thank you so much.
To our listeners, I'm Ari Barbalat, your host today on the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast. Today, I've been in dialogue with Eliana Adler and Katerina Chapkova. They're the editors of the new volume, Jewish and Romani Families in the Holocaust and Its Aftermath, published by Rutgers University Press, 2021. Eliana Adler is an associate professor in the Department of History and the Program in Jewish Studies at Pennsylvania State University. Katerina Chapkova is a senior researcher at the Institute of Contemporary History in Prague. She also teaches at Charles University and at NYU, New York University in Prague. Thank you for your generosity today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us.